why it feels like our body has changed overnight when you turn 40, because your digestion might be off, you might be bloated, gaining weight in the midsection, all the things. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smita Raman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones, sex med gynecologist and menopause specialist in downtown Chicago. Today, I'm super excited to have a friend and colleague that is going to talk to us about why it feels like our body has changed overnight when you turn 40, because your digestion might be off, you might be bloated, gaining weight in the midsection, all the things. And wondering, what is it exactly that's causing this? Is it hormones? Is it gut? Is it stress? Is it both? Is it everything all at once? We're going to get into all that. So I am just super excited to bring in Cynthia Thurlow. I had the pleasure of being on her podcast. She's a nurse practitioner, also a metabolic health expert, as well as author of the new book that has just been released, The Menopause Gut, where she breaks out on how hormone changes in perimenopause and menopause directly impact digestion, inflammation, metabolism, overall health. Thank you, Cynthia, for being here. Finally, we are doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Cancellations, time again. So I want to get right into it. So I always have to start with why. Like, why and how did you come into the space of midlife healthcare with women, and then specifically when it comes to GI issues? I know in your book you talk about your experiences, but let's educate the audience about what your why is.
Yeah, absolutely. And to give everyone some perspective, I'm someone that spent, 20 years between ER medicine and cardiology. First as a ER and trauma nurse in NICU Baltimore, and then for 16 years working in clinical cardiology as an NP. And as I like to tell everyone, I'm a reformed adrenaline junkie. And about 10 years ago, I got really tired of just writing tons and tons of prescriptions for lifestyle as medicine related issues. And so I was that typical perimenopausal female who was woefully unprepared. My lifestyle no longer matched my physiology. And so I took a massive leap of faith and really kind of dove into the perimenopause, menopause space as a perimenopausal female, and built up a business with direct patient care, group programs, did a couple TED Talks, wrote a couple books. But I think because I have a podcast myself, it's allowed me an opportunity to really interview all these thought leaders and scientists and physicians and nurse practitioners and experts. And it became very clear to me, both from my experience working with patients, but also talking to experts, that the microbiome, really, it's been the last 5 to 10 years with this burgeoning area of research, but it helps explain why so many women have bloating, constipation, diarrhea, underlying food sensitivities, brain fog, beyond just the kind of conventional perspectives that it's all driven by you eat too fast, you're too active, you're too stressed. And so during the course of the past, 2 years, when I really dove into the research, it was definitely evident to me, as we are losing progesterone, estradiol, we get a lot of alterations in motility, changes in insulin sensitivity, and we just don't feel the same. And it's not something that's contrived in our heads. It is real. I am the first person to say that doing an elimination diet in 2014, and then again in 2018, just provided a lot of insight into how my body was reacting. And then I always say the power of my experiment on myself and patients. And so it's really insightful, but I would argue that the gut microbiome, the intersection, a reflection point between every organ system in our body and every cell. And so the more that we understand the gut microbiome, the more the rest of the body makes sense to me. And it wasn't something that I learned during any of my training years ago, but really has been on the fly the last 5 to 10 years. And I would argue that there's a lot to this hormonal milieu of menopause and menopause, but in many instances, a lot of the symptoms that my patients are experiencing are really a reflection of the health of the microbiome or the biology of the microbiome.
No, I think it's totally true. And I think, there's so many properties within our hormones and how they interact with each. I always say, like, the hormones are only as good as the receptors that interact with at the tissue level. And so we don't know how your body's going to respond at different tissues. And the gut microbiome for sure, takes a hit for so many people with inflammation. Let's just first define, like, when you say menopause gut, what are you talking about?
It's really speaking to how the gut microbiome changes in perimenopause and menopause. So, not surprisingly, the gut microbiome is 40 trillion bacteria, viruses, and fungi and protozoa that accompany the large intestine or colon. So, it is a mini city. There's actually more cells in the microbiome than there are human cells. So, to give you a sense, but it's not as tangible as a heart, a lung, a vagina, a uterus. And so, because of that, people really don't fully understand or appreciate why it's so important. But when I speak to the changes that are happening in the microbiome, it's really understanding that as estrogen declines, one example, we get changes in diversity. So, the beneficial bacteria start to disappear. We have more inflammation. We get changes in immune system function, which makes us more susceptible to opportunistic infections. We get changes in key signaling molecules like short-chain fatty acids, which for everyone listening, this is why fiber becomes so important in midlife. Fiber actually ferments in the large intestine. These short-chain fatty acids are responsible for many things. Some can cross the blood-brain barrier. Some are responsible for endogenous GLP-1 stimulation, reduction in inflammation, mucus production. And so when I talk about the menopause gut, it's really the transitional point of perimenopause to menopause, so mid to late 30s into early 50s and beyond. And it helps explain a lot of the symptoms that patients experience. But as I remind my patients all the time, the gut microbiome interfaces with every single organ system. There's a gut ovarian axis, a gut bone axis, a gut brain axis, et cetera, et cetera. So there's very much this synergistic relationship, and nothing exists in a vacuum as much as we might have been trained to believe that everything exists in a siloed bucket, depending on our specialty. But I would actually argue that everything interfaces with the microbiome. So the more we can do proactively to offset what's happening hormonally and changes in neurotransmitters, probably the less symptoms our patients are going to experience and the better they're going to feel.
Yeah, for sure. Cynthia, in your book, you talk a little bit about your own, struggles as you were entering this phase, and really the GI struggles that landed you in, different urgent cares and all the things. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about that and how that was such an impetus for you to kind of be like, why don't we know more about this? Why aren't people talking about this?
Yeah, I love how life imitates art. So I went on this romantic trip to Morocco with my husband. We ate the same food. We did the same activities. One of us got really terrible food poisoning, and I actually wasn't feeling well for the duration of our trip, even going on to Spain, coming home. And it kind of set me up. I picked up a friend in Morocco, and I say a friend is an air quote friend, Giardia. I didn't yet know this. But it set me up for a second bout of food poisoning a few months later, and then ultimately a 13-day hospitalization in the hospital where I had a ruptured appendix, a whole slew of complications. And the working hypothesis all the way along was the Giardia that you picked up in Morocco was probably kind of brewing along over the past several months and probably contributed to why you ended up having this lengthy hospitalization. I had a small bowel obstruction, I had pancolitis, I had a fistula. I mean, I was so sick. And I even was so sick that when I left the hospital, I didn't have a appendectomy. I actually had to come back 6 weeks later because I was too sick to take it out. So I was sent home. And the entire time I kept saying, how does someone that's as healthy as I am get so sick? So that was number one. And then, obviously 6 weeks later, I had my appendix out. But I remember saying to the gastroenterologist, the surgeon, the infectious disease specialist, I was like, what would have happened if I had been any other 40-something-year-old person? And they're like, you probably would have died. So I'm not minimizing my experience, but when I reflected back on it, I said, I don't think I had any idea how profoundly our immune system changes and our gut permeability changes, because I obviously was exposed to a pathogen. There was a massive amount of endotoxemia. So lipopolysaccharides leaked into my bloodstream, triggered an immune response, contributed to a worsening leaky gut, and made me quite sick. And so that got me curious to better understand the physiology, because I think for many people, even healthcare providers themselves, we tend to think about perimenopause and menopause through a lens of brain, bone, and heart health solely on the cliff, and that's all that happens. But I now very humbly say it is a systemic change, and the immune system was certainly something that I didn't fully appreciate enough, because you just assume it works, right? We just feel like we fight off infections, we feel better. And yet now I understand it at a level that I never thought I would, through the lens of what's changing specifically as estrogen and progesterone are declining, that just make you so much more susceptible to opportunistic infections. And the best way I can explain it is generally ruptured appendixes happen in younger patients. Like I was on like a very kind of older age of prevalence and incidence. And, you know, all I was told over and over again was like, oh, the Giardia just started the process. It probably would have happened anyway. Having said that, so for me, it began a journey of exploration of like what's really happening at a cellular level. And then also very transparently, when you go from being so sick and you're on like 6+ weeks of antibiotics, antifungals, and you survive, you're like, okay, that's great. But now I have chronic diarrhea, and I was full carnivore for 9 months, and it took me 18 months to tolerate a cooked vegetable. And so when patients now say to me, I don't tolerate fiber, there's already bells and whistles going off in my head, because if the microbiome has been so decimated that someone is unable to tolerate fiber, it's a sense that, or gives you a sense that there is a significant change. So like every brush border enzyme, everything intrinsically that was part of my microbiome and my gastrointestinal tract had been decimated to save my life. And so it really just speaks to, number one, building awareness about how the gut changes. Number two, the humility to understand that even as licensed medical providers, sometimes we don't know everything. And then number three, what I've been able to do in terms of healing my own gut over the past 7 years has been pretty incredible. But it's information that ultimately benefits patients and became really the basis of the book.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I feel like, you know, with all that we know about, you know, perimenopause, menopause, and we know that, you know, there's so many inflammatory conditions that are hormonally susceptible, right? Like endometriosis is truly a full systemic condition that is, you know, inflammatory in nature, that has been lumped into the GYN only space, but it really can impact people from head to toe, the same as what we now refer to as polyendocrine metabolic ovarian syndrome, which is formerly known as PCOS. And so I think that we have all these inflammatory symptoms that, you know, we likely are now even more and more thinking about through the lens of even mast cells that are active, you know, in the gut and epithelium, or, you know, in the vulva vaginal vestibule. You know, we see these mast cells that, you know, really do degranulate nerve growth factors and inflammatory factors and all the things that, you know, they're regulated by hormones. So it makes you think about all the times of hormonal susceptibility that women experience, and how if they have these inflammatory sort of like conditions that are really dictating their systemic, the way their system's going to respond, how it can really like decimate the gut issues, right? Like it can really impact them significantly, to the point where I think everything gets lumped in this box of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, which is like really a diagnosis of exclusion once you've ruled out any other causes, right? And so, you know, for those of us that treat things in the GYN space, like endometriosis, some of these other inflammatory conditions, we know they're intricately linked. And so, and all of these things are hormonally susceptible. So I think it's very interesting to think about the gut in that capacity as well.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting that we're now having a much more progressive view on endometriosis as an autoimmune condition, that PMOS is finally getting the respect and, quite frankly, the focus on metabolic health that it always should have had. And I think for a lot of women, it's validating to know that endometriosis is far more more common than previously thought, that PMOS is the number one endocrine disorder that we see here in the United States, not hypothyroidism, which is commonly thought to be the case with diabetes. And so I think it really speaks to being able to serve women at a higher level and with greater awareness. Like I feel like our generation of women are just doing a much better job of advocating for ourselves as well as our patients, demanding better care, which will ultimately lead to future generations really benefiting from our own advocacy and standing up not only for ourselves, but for the quality of care that our patients should be receiving. And you know, I think a great deal about the baby boomer generation, which is my mom's generation, and how so many of them were impacted by the Women's Health Initiative. I feel like we will be doing a mea culpa forever. But also looking at their quality of life and how grateful they are that our generation is really helping to drive better outcomes for patients ultimately and getting greater clarity about a lot of these diagnoses of exclusion, whether it's fibromyalgia, whether it's endometriosis. I was talking to a colleague who's a GYN, male GYN recently, and he was saying, he's older than I am, but he said, endometriosis was thought of as just a uterine problem. And now we acknowledge that it is far more profound than that. And he said, I'm so grateful because I realized that years ago, but everyone else just wants to look at it as a container. This is a GYN problem. No, it is a systemic health issue.
And I think, you know, that is consistently probably one of the bigger problems for people navigating the healthcare system, especially women who are oftentimes dismissed because of their symptoms, is really the fact that, like, you know, if you go to, like, you know, you're trying to get some evidence-based care, so much of our care is siloed, right? Like, you're a specialist in this, you're a specialist in that, you know, this is a specialty clinic for that, that, you know, who's making the connections with everything? And that's why, like, for someone like myself and, you know, and for others like yourself as well that do treat menopause, which we know perimenopause is a full body systemic issue because we have hormones all over our body, receptors all over our body for estrogen, testosterone, all the things. And so understanding that, you know, we can't continue to just see, like, I'm a gynecologist. I used to joke, like, my area is right here, like the pelvis and blah. But like now I never say that anymore because I'm always like, no, I mean, everything that we know about hormones and these times of hormonal susceptibility, like perimenopause and going from pregnancy to postpartum or, you know, puberty, all the things, all the P's, you know, we know that these are times where, like, people have full body sort of situations happening, like systemic issues that are being impacted. Their mental health is being affected, their cognitive health, their, you know, their musculoskeletal health, their sexual health, all the things. And so it's really, we can no longer afford to continue to silo ourselves without considering other systems and how they interplay, which I think is the whole point of a lot of what you're saying, your gut.
Yeah, no, I think you said that so beautifully, that we are all interconnected, and any provider that's thinking of siloed care, especially as it pertains to midlife women, is really missing the boat. Like, I'll give you an example. I have a sty that turned into eclasion. And when I was having a conversation with my ophthalmologist, she very astutely stated, well, you realize estrogen is involved with those median glands. And that's probably why you've had your second sty in 2 years. And now we need to, you know, look at the...
Got your eyes out every day because of the dryness.
Exactly. I'm like, those darn glands, but, you know, controlled by estrogen. But I think it's time for all of us to realize, even as just middle-aged women, that it's all interconnected. There's no siloed approach to care. And if people are still working in a very siloed approach when they take care of middle-aged women, they're going to miss opportunities to serve them.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I had a discussion with Dr. Pam Mehta this morning. You know, she's an orthopedic surgeon. And when we were talking, and she was saying that, like, you know, I asked people when their last menstrual was and da-da-da, because we know about the musculoskeletal syndrome and menopause. And even my husband, who's interventional pain sports medicine, when he's treating frozen shoulder or these joint issues, he's always like, well, you know, are you still menstruating? And people are like, why is this guy asking me? But again, like, you can't separate a joint from this full person, right? Like, and so I think that it's really important that, you know, this awareness is happening. It's wonderful. And so to your point, when we talk about the gut and the brain access, Like, can we talk about that a little bit?
But when we're talking about this gut-brain access, we're really speaking to the vagus nerve. It's the longest nerve in the body. One of the cranial nerves runs from the brainstem through the digestive system, innervates nearly every organ, and is really responsible for this bidirectional communication. Interestingly enough, most of the communication is aimed at it. So it's going from the gut to the brain, not the opposite, which is what most of us are led to believe. But I remind women that what stays on in the gut doesn't stay in the gut. It's not like, Las Vegas. And so you're dealing with a lot of inflammation, a lot of opportunistic infections. You've got leaky gut. You very likely are going to have transmission of that information to the brain. So I always say the blood-brain barrier is designed to be impermeable. But more often than not, if you've got a leaky gut, you've got a leaky brain, for lack of a better way to explain it. And so you can experience neurologic symptoms that are a reflection of what's going on in the gut. So if you have a lot of inflammation, that could show up as brain fog. It can show up as changes in cognition, memory, learning, word finding. Anything related to that is not just solely related to a change in estrogen, although it can be exacerbated by that for sure. The other thing that I think is really intrinsically interesting is the bulk of the neurotransmitters that our body makes, GABA, serotonin, dopamine, et cetera, are made in the gut. And what I find infinitely interesting is, gosh, this is really dating myself. Back in the 1990s, when we were learning about selective serotonin reuptake, SSRIs, that act in the brain, it's with the understanding that actually the bulk of these neurotransmitters are created in the gut. So when someone's having mood changes, more anxiety, more lability, more irritability, more depression type symptoms, even OCD type symptoms, I'm automatically thinking, this may not just be a hormonal piece. This may actually be a contributory issue with gut inflammation or opportunistic infection. So I think the gut-brain axis is fascinating. I think that it is becoming more well known that people are making those connections, but gut-brain health is so connected, so important, so vital. And when we're talking about perimenopause, yes, a decline in progesterone can absolutely change insulin sensitivity, can change GABA signaling, can impact anxiety, depression, sleep, but it can also be a neurotransmitter problem. And so it's always a little bit of a piece of a puzzle depending on the symptoms a patient's experiencing, and then determining what's the first lever to pull. Do we add some progesterone? Do we work on your gut health? Probably we'll do both concurrently, but with the acknowledgement that healthy neurotransmitters are made in a healthy gut. And if you're eating standard American diet, drinking a lot of alcohol, smoking, toxic relationships, you have no boundaries, chronic stress is not going to help that microbiome either. And so I think on a lot of different levels, it's really thinking very comprehensively when we're talking to our patients about how the gut-brain axis influences not just our perception of self, but how we interact with our environment as well, and can lead to symptoms or can improve symptoms depending on what interventions we use.
No, totally. I think it's true. I mean, to the point of this, diagnosis of exclusion that's always been irritable bowel syndrome. It's not totally off in the fact that when people get stressed, more stressed, and they have more, anxiety. A lot of people hold that internally, right? And so, there's definitely that correlation. But I think it's bigger picture than just in your head, right? You can't disconnect it is the point, right? Like, I think what's happened so much in women's health, and you know this just as well as I do, is that we've had this historical sort of baseline systemic sexism that has existed with regard to how we view women's health care and the chronic dismissal that happens time and time again for symptoms that we don't have automatic researched answer for. Like for me in my area of what I treat on a day-to-day basis, something like sexual pain, which we've, you always tell people relax, not we, I never told anyone this, but like people have always been told, okay, you need to relax, have a glass of wine, like, do things that are, stimulate, your relationship and all the things, which, all those factors are important, but we have biologic reasons that people have sexual pain. We have pelvic floor dysfunction. We have hormonal changes. We have too many nerve endings at the opening of the vagina, at the vulvar vestibule. So there's significant issues that occur, but that's not to say that we should exclude, the components of your mood and mental health either, you know? So I think it's a fine balance of just, okay, this is all in your head, so go see a psychiatrist, versus, okay, part of it, of course, I mean, it's like anyone, right? In chronic pain patients have depression and they have anxiety, and it takes them a lot of intestinal fortitude. The patients I see that I'm their seventh or eighth provider, you know, it takes them a lot of intestinal fortitude to tell their story again, because they're afraid to get dismissed over and over again, right? So I think we can't dismiss that portion. I mean, how do you navigate that with your patients? Because I mean, that's probably what they've been told, right? This is in your head. You need to see psychiatry. You need to see a therapist.
Yeah, I think half the challenge is just listening to our patients, because when we're in a traditional environment where we're seeing a new patient every 10 or 15 minutes, and you know, we've got the handle on the door, and you're like, please don't ask me. And it's not because I don't want to listen, but if we diverge from the focus of the conversation, it then makes me, it's that domino effect of everyone thinking, okay, the next patient is going to be late, and then it becomes the entire day. But I always even say to not just other patients or clients, but to other nurse practitioners, other physicians that I interact with, I'm like, 90% is just listening to the patient in a safe space, in a non-judgmental space. And to your point about how many women have been dismissed, whether it's pain, sexual dysfunction, digestive issues, mental health issues, they have tried to create safe spaces to share their concerns, but they're either being viewed as, okay, well, I'm trying to figure out where to put this patient into a bucket. So are they in a pain bucket? Are they in a mental health bucket? Are they in multiple buckets? I think in many instances, patients are, they're so concerned that they're not going to be able to speak their truth, or they're not going to be supported in a way that is going to allow them the opportunity to share what they're concerned about, especially for someone that has high ACE scores, PTSD history. For a lot of these patients, feeling a sense of comfort in sharing and disclosing very personal things, things that they might otherwise not even speak to their spouse about, or even a close friend. So I think creating that environment where patients feel comfortable to share is number one. And then it's okay to not know exactly what's going on with the patient, but saying, okay, well, I'm not 100% sure what the next step needs to be, but I'm going to find out. Or if I'm not the right person, I'm going to make sure I get you to the right person. Because inevitably, in my line of work, sometimes someone needs to see gastroenterology, sometimes someone needs to see hematology, someone needs to see a gynecologic expert. And I have no problems making referrals. But I think in many ways, kind of the patriarchal nature of medicine has allowed many women to experience a lot of pain, a lack of communication, an acceptance of this is just the way things are, just accept it. I think even for myself, you know, even my experiences when I went from reproductive endocrinology trying to get pregnant to a specialist during my pregnancies, and I just happened to have male providers who were great, but there were definitely moments that even with as much information as I knew, I was like, we're just assuming that everything hurts, every intervention hurts, everything hurts. No one's really explaining to me what to expect. And so I just share that just to say that even a licensed medical provider can sometimes not even articulate or feel comfortable in an environment to share how they're feeling if they don't feel safe. You know, I don't feel safe because maybe someone has experienced some type of sexual trauma or sexual abuse. And I don't mean to get off on this tangent, but it's relevant to the gut because we know that, you know, adverse childhood events, high ACE scores, PTSD will rewire our autonomic nervous system, absolutely makes us more susceptible to chronic pain-related issues, poor metabolic health, disordered relationships with food, contributes to high autoimmune disease risk. And sometimes we're not screening our patients properly. That's the point of what I'm trying to make, is that sometimes, and I'm not suggesting you do this, but I think there are those of us that sometimes are not thinking that way. And until someone gives us an indication that that's a concern of theirs, sometimes we're not doing a great job of screening. And I think screening for PTSD, trauma, adverse childhood events is certainly really part of the conversation. Because I know for myself, I do screen now. And I would say easily 40% of my patients have high ACE scores. So I already know what they're at risk for. And it allows me to deliver, quite honestly, better care. And in some instances, they've been they've had an entire lifetime of subjugating themselves for such a long period of time. I feel like perimenopause is the time that all of that falls away, because all those compensatory behaviors, mechanisms that they've used to be successful individuals start to fall away when the hormones change, the neurotransmitters change, their physiology changes, and their coping skills just don't allow them to keep everything contained. All of a sudden it becomes messy, and messy isn't necessarily bad.
Scaffold that we have, you know, kind of just like gets pulled from underneath us.
Exactly.
And people really strong. Now, to your point about the patients too, and as clinicians and looking at these patients, I mean, there's actually a term, I think it was coined in the 1980s, this term called the heart sink patient, which is like where clinicians, doctors, you know, nurse practitioners, whatever, when you see a patient with a chief complaint of, you know, GI distress or, you know, pelvic pain, sexual pain, endometriosis, those, and even patients know that they're considered heart sink patients, which is devastating. But it's like your heart sinks because you're in a system where you have to see 30 patients a day that you haven't, we haven't done enough research to know the answers. Or if there are answers out there, you know, you haven't had the chance to get up to date enough to know the answers to get to help the patients. And so I think it goes back to, you know, having a little bit of, you know, cultural humility and understanding that, you know, and this is, you know, something the lens I try to practice within is just like, okay, I know a lot, I don't know everything, and I want to make sure that I'm listening to you to be able to get you to the best person. And I'm happy to be your quarterback in this scenario and make sure that we're, you know, talking to the right people. But
I think that's the key, the humility piece. I think that I've always said to patients, I don't know everything, but I know that if I don't know, I will find the person that does know. And I think that that conveys such a degree of compassion to patients to say, I'm humble enough to say I don't have all the answers, but by the same token, I'm committed to being your advocate in this circumstance. And I think for a lot of women, that can be, you know, life-changing, life-defining for them to feel like someone's finally seeing them for who they are and wants to genuinely help them instead of the, oh my gosh, I have the handle on the door. Like I speak very openly that when I worked in cardiology, I had a colleague that used to say to me, he who has the list is in control. So if a patient comes in with a list, you need to get the list because you control the conversation. And I understand intellectually why he said that to me when I was a younger nurse practitioner. But when I say that now, it makes me cringe because what you're essentially saying is I'm controlling the conversation so that I don't have to spend too much time in this room.
Yeah. No, that's true too. I mean, and that's just sort of like the epistemic injustice that we know exists on a day-to-day basis with our patients. So tell me like what you, where do you start when you have someone that has gut disruption, that there's coming to you new inflammation, new bowel dysfunction, can't tolerate fiber like they used to, can't do this and that. Like, do you start with an elimination diet?
Oh, absolutely. I think that in a food diary, not forever. The food diary can feel really tedious, but it's like, I want to know exactly what your symptoms are when you eat breakfast. What are the foods you're eating and how do you feel an hour later? You know, same thing with lunch and dinner. And so I find that I get good buy-in with a elimination diet slowly. Like if I just say to someone, do a whole 30, most people can't cut out that many things. So I will sometimes start with gluten or dairy. Those are pretty hard for most people to do because they have to re-engineer their meals. And depending on someone's background, dairy can be a big part of their diet. But I do find that those two interventions, along with some alcohol, plus or minus sugar, can be very helpful. It's also starting with the basics. Like I always say, major in the majors. Before my patients buy an Oura ring or a Whoop band or some expensive gym equipment, I'm like, listen, I want you to have at least one or two meals a day where you are seated while you're eating, not dictating and eating, not eating in the car, not eating when you're yelling at your kids. Sit and take 4 to 5 deep breaths before you start eating so that you're trying to get your brain into out of the sympathetic into the parasympathetic, or taking a walk after a meal, or drinking more water. Like something that is so simple, almost seems trite, can make a big difference. When someone tells me they're having energy issues and they're tired, I'm like, are you dehydrated? We know that we, as we're losing estrogen, we're losing control of these baroreceptors, we are not as physiologic aware of when we become dehydrated. It's like by the time we're thirsty, we're probably already dehydrated. So hydration, walking, breath work can be very, very helpful. And then simplifying, like instead of adding more, it's just really the simplification piece of like, let's focus on a little more protein before we even get to fibers and interventions. Like try to eat less processed food, try to eat a little bit more protein. Because if I look at food diaries, 95% of my patients don't eat enough protein. That's problem number one. And it's not that most of them don't tolerate fiber. It's just they've been eating such hyper palatable food for so long, which is devoid of fiber, that when they start introducing more fibrous foods, more often than not, they'll say, I get bloated. I feel like I'm puffy. I got constipated. And like, well, we don't go from 10 grams of fiber a day to 30. You'll definitely feel the effects of that. But let's kind of keep a food diary, track our macros. Then from there, we can make decisions. And I tend to go pretty slowly with fiber. And I tend to stick with things that I know are pretty well tolerated, like fresh ground flax and chia seeds, you know, cooked vegetables. Like sometimes people want to have this big crudité platter. And I'm like, listen, if you're not fiber, if you're pretty fiber sensitive, eating raw vegetables is probably not the direction to go in. Like you are going to get bloated. If I sat down and ate a bunch of raw broccoli and cauliflower, I would definitely be bloated just because that's not my preferred way to eat them. But really starting with...
Or I used to love watermelon and it makes me... Yeah. But you figure it out, right? You figure it out by...
Exactly. And so we kind of go from there. We start with simple things. We move on to diagnostic testing. I mean, I'm a fan of microbiome testing. I do think that there's a lot of validity there, but we're also not adding 90 supplements. I mean, that's something that I see a lot in the integrative medicine space is that patients go from, okay, I'm out of a traditional model. I'm seeing an integrative or functional provider and the patients come to me and they're on 40 supplements. I'm like, do you want to be on 40 supplements? And they're like, no.
I'm like, and they showed me all their supplements. And I was like, no wonder you can't keep up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's overwhelming. So I try to keep it simple. I've learned that we do two or three interventions at every visit and I get better. I hate to use the word compliance, but I get better patient buy-in because we're keeping it simple. And then it's kind of like we're slowly walking into the pool. We're not just jumping in. It's rare for me to find a patient that wants to do everything all up front. That's very rare. But doing it that way,
once. I mean, I always say to myself, like, I can't even follow half the stuff I tell.
I know. And I think, you know, half the battle is, and I'll tell patients, I'm like, listen, it's hard for me to integrate 10 new supplements into my regimen. Like, I don't expect you to do it. Like, we'll just do one at a time. If we have five, we're going to start with digestive support. We're going to, before we even worry about a probiotic, like, let's eat some more probiotic rich food. Like, just keep it really simple. Because that's sustainable. No one wants to be on 40 supplements. No one wants to be on a complicated regimen. I think most people don't want to have to pay for 10 out-of-pocket tests every single year. I mean, if there's a year that happens, that's one thing. But I think most people have budgets and have lives and don't want to feel like they have to be obsessive about all of these simple little interventions.
Mm-hmm. For sure. No, I love that. I love the small interventions. I love just, you know, trying to look at how they're dealing with lifestyle. Tell me where you fall into intermittent fasting.
Well, obviously I'm known for intermittent fasting, but I can tell you over the past 2 years, I've pivoted. My dad died in 2024. And one of the things that contributed to my father's death was significant sarcopenia and falls. He ended up dying of a subdural hematoma. It did not want surgery. It was traumatizing as a medical person because I was respectful and agreed that he didn't want an intervention and the trauma surgeon and the ICU doc were very appreciative because he would have been a terrible surgical candidate. But it really left an indelible impression on me because my dad and I had very similar body habits. He's kind of a little guy. And it really impressed upon me, like if I don't get more persistent about strength training, like doing it regularly, not making excuses. Oh, I'm on a business trip. I'm not going to worry about it. I hired a personal trainer who comes to my house. So I have no excuses. And I put on 4 pounds of muscle mass in a year, but that was a lot of work. But going through that just really taught me that in order to build muscle, I need to lift regularly and I have to eat enough protein. So this is where I'm coming around to the intermittent fasting piece. when I started tracking my macros, I wasn't consistently getting enough protein in. And so I now refer to digestive rest, 12 to 13 hours of digestive rest, which even my very athletic adult sons can do. But that allows me to get three meals in a day, and that allows me to get enough protein. And so it doesn't mean that I don't think that intermittent fasting can be a valuable strategy, but it's in the context of, can you get enough protein in? Are you managing your stress? Are you sleeping? Because if you're not doing those two things, you have no business doing fasting. And that's why the 12 to 13 hours, I think, is helpful. And the caveat is, I do have women that I work with who are not metabolically healthy, significantly overweight, and intermittent fasting, like compressing their feeding window, can be helpful from a caloric restriction perspective, provided that they can get enough protein in. So that's always the conversation. So I'm not a huge fan anymore of like very long fasts because I'm so concerned about building and maintaining muscle. And I think for a lot of women, we start to realize in perimenopause and menopause, it just gets a little bit harder. And that little bit harder can be the differentiator between healthy body composition and really unhealthy body composition. Because I'm sure that you see it too. I see a lot of women now with the rise of the GLP-1s. Yes, people are losing weight, which is great. It's fighting food noise, which is great. We're starting to see the pendulum swing. Like, I remember what the 1990s were like when women were really, really thin. Yeah, exactly. And what I see when I look at people like that, I mean, I think Demi Moore is the best example I can give that I think everyone probably listening knows. When I see Demi Moore, I see her not from a place of judgment, but I'm like, sarcopenia leads to frailty, frailty leads to falls, and falls lead to a loss of independence. That is what I can see when I look at her, is she's so frail. She looks like a China doll. Like if you knocked her over, she'd break a bone. And so those are the things I think about now as a 50-plus-year-old woman. I don't want to be that kind of burden to my family. Like, that's why I do a lot of things. Like my husband will laugh at me some of the things I do in the house. And I'm like, listen, I don't want to be that little old lady who falls and breaks a hip. Like, I want to be independent. And that's why strength training becomes important. And that's why digestive rest has become a greater focus than intermittent fasting. And I think for a lot of people, they respect the fact that I've been very open about that. I mean, obviously, I've written a book on fasting for women that came out 4 years ago, but I always say, know better, do better. Like, now I know better, and now I do better. But protein and strength training are really a huge focus of what I do and recommend to patients.
No, perfect. I love that. Well, I appreciate you being on today. I do something at the end called, this is pretty much like a hot take. It's a vigilante verdict because my listeners are vigilantes. So what would you, what's your vigilante verdict? Hot
I'm
take.
sorry. I'm sorry.
What's your hot take or vigilante verdict for the
Sorry.
listeners on, or one thing that you want them to know for advocacy or, you know, whatever, you know, that they take in with when they see their clinicians, or when they're thinking about their own gut health.
Yeah, so there's definitely an interrelationship between the health of the gut microbiome and the vaginal microbiome. So that's number one. Number two is it's never too late to have that conversation. Like, I just had vaginal microbiome testing and I was like, I'm on vaginal estrogen. Mine will be perfect. And I was like, you know what's amazing? I got the results. I met with a clinician and the clinician made some recommendations. And what's amazing to me is the recommendation she made, it's like, it's impacting my libido. I'm like, so clearly something is going on there. So you're never too old. It's never too late. And you should never feel ashamed or uncomfortable advocating for your sexuality or advocating for your vulvovaginal health. That would be kind of my big takeaway. I think sometimes, even for those of us that are licensed medical providers, we're uncomfortable talking about our sexuality just personally. And it's like we have to kind of check our own comfort level at the door for the benefit of our patients.
100%. Well, thank you, Cynthia. This has been great. Everyone can go out and buy the Menopause Gut. I think we will put a link here so that you can pick it up and tell everyone where they can find you otherwise.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure to connect with you. So easiest to go to my website, www.cynthiafolo.com. My podcast is Everyday Wellness. Mina's been a guest on there before, definitely a fan favorite. and I'm active across social media. I would say right now I'm most impassioned about Substack. Like, if you really want to get to know me and what I think about a lot of different topics, not just about hormones and not just about the gut microbiome, but a lot of different things, Substack is a great place to connect with me. I'm probably most active on Instagram, although my team would be more active on TikTok, but I just can't do it.
So hard. I know, I need to get a team to do mine too. It's hard. It is hard. Anyway, thank you so much, Cynthia. This has been great. Thanks for joining us today, everyone. Remember, I'm Gyno Girl, Dr. Samina Rahman. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.